Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Carla Bellamy about her wonderful book, The Powerful Ephemeral, Everyday Healing in an Ambiguously Islamic Place, University of California Press, 2011. In The Powerful Ephemeral, Carla Bellamy explores the role of saint shrines in India, while focusing on a particular venue known as Hussein Tekri, or Hussein Hill. Through her in-depth ethnographic research, Bellamy's monograph provides vivid description and analysis of the site, as well as first-person narratives of pilgrims, in order to offer a dynamic portrayal of the shrine complex. Bellamy shows how lines between religious communities are often fluid rather than fixed. She also problematizes notions of so-called spirit possession, interrogates the metaphysical power of frankincense, and articulates myriad perspectives on what healing might mean for those who visit Hussein Tekri and participate in its rituals. Bellamy's rich ethnography should appeal to numerous audiences, including those interested in South Asia, shrine culture, Islam, Indian religion, and Sufism. Well, thank you for agreeing to join us today, Carla.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd like to start out by asking you to tell us a little bit about your academic background and how you got interested in this topic of shrine culture in India.
Okay. One of my undergraduate majors was religion. So I've had an interest in religion for a long time, though as an undergrad, it wasn't particularly focused. I was an undergrad at St. Olaf College. It's a liberal arts college in the Midwest. They have a huge and very well-respected religion department, actually. So there were a lot of really important mentors I had there. Then I took a little time off and decided maybe I did want to go to grad school. And I applied to a number of places. I ended up at Harvard Divinity School. So obviously at that point, as I began to become more interested in South Asia, I encountered Diana Eck, Ali Asani. Were probably two people there who shaped my thinking quite a bit. At that point, I was studying Sanskrit. Stephanie Jameson was there, so she was my first Sanskrit teacher. I took a little time off doing that degree because I wasn't sure I wanted to stay in academia, but then I decided I would. And it was actually in a seminar with Diana Eck that on pilgrimage that I first encountered Sufi saint shrines. The topic of Sufi saint shrines. And I was fascinated by them primarily because I couldn't think of an analog in, you know, the quote unquote West in Europe, in the United States, that something that was sort of explicitly religious and yet something that attracted people from different religious backgrounds. So I wrote my big seminar paper in that class on the shrine, the very famous Dargah in Ajmer. And what I found at the time, and this is a while ago now, I guess, 97 maybe, was that there wasn't an awful lot written in English about Sufi saint shrines in India at all. So I think at that point, maybe I decided that that might be something I wanted to pursue further in a PhD program. I did my PhD at Columbia. Jack Hawley was my primary mentor. Columbia was kind of going through a period of time where they didn't have a steady Islamicist there, actually, problematic. But Nagin Yavari, who actually works on Iran, was there, and she was an invaluable guide to me in working on the culture of Muslim saint shrines in South Asia, just keeping me informed about the sort of greater Islamic, I guess you could say, side of the culture of these places. So I guess that's how I got interested in the topic. It was something that sort of came out in the course of my master's studies and then became more focused when I was doing my PhD at Columbia.
And can you tell us about where you did your field work and how long you were there?
Yeah. So the shrine that is the subject of my first book is in Madhya Pradesh, which is the sort of the landlocked central portion of India. The name literally means middle state. The shrine is in the town of Jaora, which was the capital of a princely state a Muslim princely state of the same name up until the time of independence. The shrine Hussein Tikri, which literally means the Hill of Hussein, Hussein being, you know, from the early period of Islamic history, sort of the martyr of Karbala, that Hussein, that shrine in Madhya Pradesh was the primary site of my research. In total, it's hard to say how much time I've spent there. I mean, it's definitely been 2 years in pretty big chunks, but the research relationship with that shrine started in 99 and has continued in one form or another until now. So, yeah, it's a place that I know well.
Uh-huh. So when you first went there and began your ethnographic research, what kinds of questions did you set out to explore?
My leading question is the one that I had sort of formed when I was still a master's student at Harvard, and that was, what is religion? Well, what does it mean? I think it was just more general, actually, at the beginning. What does it mean that there's this place that's ostensibly a religious place or a place of pilgrimage, something that I would categorize as a religious place anyway, that attracts people from different religious backgrounds? And then as, I guess, the research went on, I found that, among other things, Muslim Hussein shrines generally, Hussein Tikri in particular, were a wonderful site for kind of considering what religion as a category or as a phenomenon might mean in South Asia or maybe just in India. So I think that ultimately became the lead question or the guiding question of what became my first book.
Mm-hmm. And so just now in the text as well, you use the term Muslim saint shrine, but Of course it's much more complicated than that, which you go into some detail about. So could you say something about how this place that you study complicates common perceptions of religious identity and categories?
Yes. Let me think about how best to do that. How to start. At the beginning of the book, almost immediately, I sort of confronted, as you point out, the sort of problem of terminology and what am I going to call this categorically? And as I explained at the beginning of the book, I chose the term Muslim Saint Shrine with an awareness of sort of the problematic nature of sort of the generic term saint in English, its clear connection to Christian notions of sainthood, Catholic notions of sainthood, which are very, very different. And as I explain in the beginning of the book, the primary reason that I chose to call them Muslim saint shrines is that it reflects sort of the generic language that people often used with me to describe what Hussein Tikri was, the generic term darga, being applied to a wide range of shrines or types of shrine in South Asia, some that are more closely affiliated with the Shia community, shrines that are affiliated with different Sufi lineages, shrines that are associated with a local religious figure who maybe wasn't formally attached to any Sufi lineage. So you could, from the outside or from within any of those particular traditions, make a distinction between one type of saint shrine and another. But from the outside, or when people are sort of talking about going to these shrines for the purposes of healing particularly, they would use somewhat generic language. And so I chose in English to use that categorization, and the language that I chose was Muslim saint shrine.
Mm-hmm. So what about when you're chatting with people formally or informally in India about your project, or even outside of India, and you talk about studying these Muslim saint shrines, do conversations come up where you find yourself, I mean, defending the categories that you've suggested, or people saying, oh, well, that's not really true Islam or something like that?
Yeah, pretty much every reaction you could imagine, which is a large part of what I write about in the book, is that Muslim saint shrines are, this is part of the reason the subtitle of the book is Everyday Healing in an Ambiguously Islamic Place. Part of what I meant by ambiguously Islamic was just this, that depending on, you know, who you're talking to, either in South Asia or outside or in the South Asian diaspora, you're going to get almost any kind of reaction you could possibly imagine. So anything from, yes, people saying this is not true Islam, to people saying, this sounds like a very nice thing, and I didn't think Islam was nice at all. Or people saying these aren't really Muslim places, they only became Muslim after partition when identity became so politicized, and then, you know, the Muslims really asserted identity in a way they hadn't before. Those are three or four examples of the different ways that people will conceptualize these shrines, depending on not only their ethnic and religious background, but also kind of where they are in their lives and their relationship with these shrines.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the history of the shrine that you focus on in particular?
Yeah, I can. So Hussein Tekeri, like I said, is this shrine built in the Muslim princely state of Jawra. I should also say, because I think it's interesting and important in some ways, that I found this shrine. I talk about this as well in the book. Back when I was doing advanced Hindi language study in Udaipur, the woman in whose home I was a paying guest had a charismatic healing practice that she did on her roof on Thursday evenings. And over the course of the time that I lived with her, I learned about her relationship with Hussein Tekeri, which was the place that she had gone to find healing when she had been facing some significant problems in her life many years earlier. So the very short version of the origin of Hussein Tekeri is recorded. The earliest version of the origin story is from a royal history that was commissioned by the royal family of the princely state of Jawra just a few years after the miraculous events that are understood to have caused it to come into existence, that has caused Hussein Tekeri to come to an existence. So according to this earliest account, in 1886, there was a concurrence of the Hindu festival of Dashera and the 8th, 9th, and or 10th of Muharram. That's obviously not something that would happen every year because of the way the Islamic calendar works, but that year it did happen, and it did, actually. If you go and you look at gazetteers from that time, you see that there was a coincidence of those two holidays. And there was some disagreement in Jawra about how to handle the Hindu and Muslim festivals on the streets of Jawra. And as a result of that disagreement, in the farmland and or quote-unquote jungle outside of the town of Jawra proper, there's this miraculous appearance of people leading the Taziyah procession that should have taken place in Jawra, but leading it out sort of in the jungle. And the place where that miraculous Taziyah procession is understood to have happened is the place where Hussein Tekeri now stands. I think most of the people listening to this will know what a Taziyah is, or certainly they'll know about sort of what's commemorated on the 8th, 9th, 10th of Muharram, the martyrdom of Hussein at Karbala and members of his family. And in South Asia particularly, Taziyah are sort of replicas of the tombs of the martyrs of Karbala that are carried in processions. There's a state Taziyah in Jawra, and each Muslim caste community had its own, still does in Jawra, build their own, still do. So the Taziyah are sort of simultaneously symbols of sort of Hussein and his family and his martyrdom on the one hand, and also particular Muslim communities that are often caste-based. So So it's sort of a story of a conflict averted. There isn't a fight in Jawra, and there's this miraculous procession outside of Jawra. And it's after that that you have the building of the shrines, which are funded and actually not primarily by the princely state, but by a segment of the Khoja community of Mumbai. The Khoja community is, as probably some people listening will know, an interesting subset of the Muslim community in South Asia. Many, but not all of them, are Ismaili. And that's sort of another long piece to the story, sort of how that Khoja community came to be affiliated with the Sunni princely state of Jawra and ultimately fund the shrines that the earliest shrines that are sort of built on the site. In subsequent decades, different communities funded the building of different shrines in memory of different martyrs of Karbala on the site. But the oldest shrine there is something that traces its history to the Khojas of Mumbai, a group of which still come to Hussein Tekeri every year for the major Muslim and particularly Shia holidays.
Mm-hmm. So building off the
rich, interesting history that you've been telling us about and how identity plays into that. What types of people visit the shrine today or were visiting when you were doing your field work? And why would people want to come to this place?
Right. I guess there's sort of two things I want to say about that are the most important. The first is the sort of with regard to how I wanted to do this research or perform this, you know, do this project, perform this research. When I was reading about the culture of Muslim saint shrines, it's duly noted in anything it was. Things have changed now. I think there's been some really wonderful scholarship in the past few years, but still not enough, I think. Most scholarship early on would duly note, oh yes, lots of people come who aren't Muslim, but it wouldn't talk at all about what it meant to those people to go to this place. And so for two reasons, because my background is far more actually, I think, in the study of Hinduism than it is in the study of Islam, but also because I saw sort of a huge gap in the literature, my focus in sort of talking about the different kinds of people who go to Muslim saint shrines, and you see this clearly in the book, is people who don't actually have a Muslim background, though there are significant representatives of both the Shia and the Sunni tradition in my book. You know, the people that I focus on, by and large, don't know very much about Islam before they come to a place like Hussein Tikri for healing. So my focus was on non-Muslim pilgrims, despite sort of the very clear Muslim history of the place. You know, it's in a Muslim princely state. It's funded by the Hoxha community. And the kinds of people, I think the question was originally, you know, what kind of people come? Well, primarily people. It sort of mirrors the demographics of India itself, right, where Muslims are a minority. So any Muslim saint shrine that I've been to, certainly Hussein Tikri, this is true, most of the time, most people who go there actually don't have a Muslim background. So, you know, it's your other religions of the subcontinent, you know, Christianity and Hinduism, Sikhism, Jains as well. You know, any religion you can possibly think of has representatives who are going to Muslim saint shrines, particularly for healing.
So could you say more about why would Hindus want to visit a Muslim saint shrine? I think particularly it's aside from, you know, maybe some curious religious studies people in the academy and other people as well. I think Americans don't usually like you go to temples or religious places that are outside of their tradition,
right,
especially like on a regular basis, mm-hmm, even. So could you say something about how we could understand why Hindus would go to this Muslim place?
Yes. Another reason that the book is subtitled Ambiguously Islamic Place, Everyday Healing in an Ambiguously Islamic Place, is because whether or not the shrine is regarded as Islamic by non-Muslim patrons and what they think of as Islamic, if they do regard it as sort of an Islamic, you know, or a Muslim place, varies tremendously depending on the background of the person and sort of where they are in the course of their healing process. So I'm going to give you some reasons, and I don't think we would have time to go through.
Sure.
There are almost as many reasons as there are people, but here are a couple of the big ones. First of all, this was one of the more interesting things that I think I ultimately found, is that if people, prior to really serious ethnographic work being done on Muslim saint shrines in India, if people thought at all or about what it might mean to non-Muslims to be in a place like this, they sort of say, well, you know, it's bhakti, it's devotional religion, which is the, you know, a form of religiosity that all South Asian communities share. And so it's about devotion to the saint. And that's primarily how we can explain the experience of people going there, which is true. I certainly found that to be a part of the reason that non-Muslim pilgrims find these sites so attractive and so therapeutic. But in spending a lot of time there and getting to know some people quite well over a number of years, it became clear as well that sort of the opposite sort of relationship was also going on, where the Muslim site would be regarded as exotically or dangerously other. And part of the therapeutic value of going there is sort of knowing that you're going somewhere that's completely outside of the world that you live in most of the time, in a way that's almost socially unacceptable, almost dangerous. So that's one surprising, at least maybe a little bit disturbing as well, attraction that I found non-Muslim pilgrims having to the place, is that, oh, this place is ritually impure, this place is dangerous, this place is, it's transgressive for me to go here, it's transgressive for me to become friends with, not just Muslims, but Muslims from different caste communities, all of these things. So that's a major element of the attraction, and I think also a major element of the therapeutic power of these places. So that's one. Another is the fact that the rituals of healing that are performed at a place like Hussein Tikri and at a lot of Muslim saint shrines are quite unstructured and often without a religious leader sort of directing them. So they can be in some ways very self-directed. And for people who are dealing with problems with extended families, frustrations with sort of their economic situation, what we would call psychological problems, particularly that may ultimately result in physical problems, just stress causing illness. Having a very open-ended repertoire of rituals is potentially incredibly therapeutic, because depending on what you want a ritual to mean or what you want to have happen, you can understand the ritual in any number of ways, and you can perform the ritual in any number of ways and sort of see if it works for you and intuit whether it does or not. So sort of speaking very generally, the rituals at Muslim saint shrines in particular are open-ended in a way that is somewhat unique in the subcontinent, and therefore potentially extremely therapeutic to anyone, not just, you know, Muslim or non-Muslim. And that's, I think, another reason that they're very attractive places to people and ultimately places that people find very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. And could you also say something about, you in your book, you write about what it's like to be there as a woman and a Westerner, as someone who kind of stands out. So could you say something about how that affected your experience, and if there were other non-South Asians that frequented these places?
Yes, I can talk a little bit about that. I think that the most, let me think. Yes, so being a visible minority and a woman in South Asia generally, and at these shrines in particular, it means everybody notices you right away, and everybody has, you know, it's like any situation where you're a visible minority, there are stereotypes that you have to contend with. And so in some ways that can be challenging. But one thing that I think was really helpful about being sort of a clear outsider is that as I got to know people well, I think in a way there's a certain personality type anyway that, and this was true of the people that I got to know the best, certainly, there's a certain personality type where if you're talking to someone who's so clearly outside of your world, you can be more open with them and not worry about judgment, because you realize they aren't going to judge you in the way maybe people in your community would, and they're also probably going away. So I think in that way, being sort of a visible minority and a clear sort of outsider was very helpful. Also, particularly at a Muslim saint shrine like Hussein Tikri, almost everyone who goes there is sort of an outsider in one way or another. They feel alienated from their home communities. And right. So going to a place like Hussein Tikri is sort of like coming home in a way for people who feel really like outside of where they should be.
Yeah.
So that makes everybody just a little bit more open anyway. There's a cosmopolitanism in some ways at shrines like this that I write a little bit about that I think also makes, you know, people more willing to talk. With regard to sort of, I've talked a little bit about being sort of a visible minority, a Westerner, and I've talked mainly about how that sort of the positive effect that had in my research. There were negative effects as well, which I can talk about maybe if we have time, but I think it's also important to address the gender part of your question. Being a woman, I do write about this a little bit in the book. So I had a lot more access to domestic space and to female informants than most male researchers, I think, would. And as I write in my book, that means that the focus in this project is far more on female pilgrims than male pilgrims. Just practically speaking, that was sort of how it had to be.
Right.
But that doesn't make my research, ethnographic research, any more gendered than the ethnographic research of anyone else who works in South Asia. It's just that I think historically, anyway, there's been a tendency for, you know, women to talk a little bit more, women, female scholars, to talk a little bit more about gender or how their work is gendered than there has been for male scholars. So definitely being a woman made me focus more on women subjects.
Right.
Informants. But at the same time, because I was sort of this, you know, outsider woman, a Westerner, and sort of one of the stereotypes about Western women is we're horribly debased, basically.
Right. You have a line in the book where you say that just sort of bluntly, and I found myself laughing because it was relatable, but you're just so straightforward about this perception.
Yeah. It's exactly right. So, oh, well, but you know, and you use it to your advantage. And so what that meant was, you know, everybody, I was already debased. So I was actually, you know, I could, you know, it was a much harder situation to manage because there would be sort of assumptions sometimes, but I could also, you know, spend time with male informants and sort of go into male places of power and talk to people. And it would just be okay. Cause I was, you know, a Western female. So I think in some ways, sort of how I presented in terms of my ethnicity and my nationality and my gender was really helpful. Something I could really work with.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting how you position your experience in the sense that everyone that is going there is an outsider on some level, and it's stepping into this realm of the other. And so in that way, you also have this camaraderie that you talk about when you're getting off the train, that you felt this,
yeah,
this mixture of fear and camaraderie.
Yeah, that's, I think that, and I did really mean that. I felt very similar to people there in some ways, in the ways that you talk about. Yeah.
So this Hussein Tikri place that you're talking about is so multidimensional, and there are just so many different aspects we could talk about. But as expressed in the title of your book, and you talk about in some detail, you talk about healing and the different meanings that can have, from spiritual or medicinal or what have you. So could you talk a little bit about what you mean by healing and how that manifests at the shrine?
Yes. And again, it's hard to speak really generally because, you know, depending on where people are in their healing process, what their ethnic and religious background is, it does mean different things. But I think there are a few things that a lot of people share. And I'm trying to think. One thing certainly is the feeling that being sick is kind of a social state, not an individual state.
Mm-hmm.
So that the measure of being healed is largely the measure of the extent to which one is able to reintegrate with one's social group, family, caste, friends, whatever community the person who comes to Hussein Tikri feels alienation from is the community they want to go back to. So whether it's what we would call a psychological or a spiritual or a mental or a physical problem that's keeping people from performing as they would like to in their community. For most people, I guess the variety comes from whether it's what we would call a psychological or a spiritual or an emotional or, you know, physical problem.
Mm-hmm.
For most people, regardless of religious background, you know, the measure of healing is the measure of the extent to which you're able to kind of resume normal social function. For men, often that means gainful employment. For women, often that means children, not always, but often. So I think speaking generally, when you're talking about healing at a place like Muslim Saint Shrines or Hussein Tikri in particular, you're talking about that kind of healing, just being reintegrated.
Mm-hmm. So you also discuss a little about the types of experiences people have when they're experiencing healing or praying or however mm-hmm. you want to describe it. And one thing that you talk about is this idea of spirit possession. And of course, you problematize it. So
yeah.
Could you say something about these types of experiences where people are breathing in irregular ways, and also the way that scholars conceptualize this and how you want to reframe the way we understand this category of so-called spirit possession.
Yeah, thanks for saying so-called. Yeah, in the book, I choose to leave the term that would often be translated spirit possession untranslated, the term that people use at Hussein Tekri, which is used widely at Muslim saint shrines, certainly in northern India, is Haziri, which comes from an Urdu word that means presence. Mm. It has a history, a very clear history that's tied back to the notion of presence in a royal court. So sort of, or which is also in some ways like a legal court, sort of the idea of going before the ruler and pleading your case and receiving justice that you have not been able to receive. So in the context of Hussein Tekri, when people talk about Haziri, the basic conceit is that they go, not just at Hussein Tekri, but at certain kinds of Muslim saint shrines throughout northern India, certainly, and also southern India. The conceit is when you walk into that space, you're walking into the court of the saint. And the saint is functioning like a ruler. And as I write about in the book, this is a form that you see also in the Hindu tradition, though there are some important differences. And the language used in the Hindu context is similar to that of the Muslim saint shrine context. So you walk in, and at Hussein Tekri, and so it varies from place to place, but at Hussein Tekri, the standard template is you walk in because you're having problems, you don't know what they are, you tie a little string to the screens of the, on the windows, the metal sort of grating on the windows of the shrine, which signals your readiness to receive the judgment of the saint. And then if someone's performed magic on you, the idea is that in the course of being in the presence of the saint will begin at some point to discipline whatever malevolent spiritual presence has been placed inside of you, usually by magic, by a magician who's been hired, usually by somebody you know well, often by a member of your family. That malevolent presence, which has been put in you, which has been giving you the psychological, spiritual, physical problems, will begin to experience a lot of distress because the saint will begin physically punishing it, basically beating it. It's like I say, I don't know if I say this actually in the book, but it is essentially using torture to elicit a confession, whatever you think of that. Mm. That's what it is. And all of the violent activity that you see in the body of the person who's having Haziri is sort of the malevolent spiritual presence reacting to this corporal punishment. And then in sort of the streamlined narrative that people will give about how Haziri works, at a certain point, there'll be a confession where the malevolent presence will say who sent it and how much was paid and what the motivation was. And then it will either be understood to leave of its own accord. The person might cough up nails or glass or lemons or any number, or the food that into which the magic was put. All of these, the person might hire somebody who works at the shrine to perform any one of a series of rituals to sort of trap the malevolent presence in something else. So there are all different ways that ultimately the presence can come out. But in the end, the result of Haziri ideally is that. The reason I didn't want to call it spirit possession is I thought that, I mean, the shortest way to state it is I just thought that that placed the agency in entirely the wrong place and reflected a notion of selfhood that's really not operative mm-hmm. at Muslim saint shrines. Because in spirit possession, it sort of was not, and sort of expanding on that, well, let me think of just the most concise way to expand on that. What's most powerful, I think, about the practice of Haziri is sort of encoded in the name of the practice itself, which, as you recall, means presence, mm-hmm. right? So what's powerful about the practice is that the person has left their community and come to this new place. And for lots of different reasons, that's a transformative experience for them. And it also means that the agency of the practice is not really located in them as a sort of a conscious, willing actor, or even in the spirit as a conscious or willing actor, or even really in some ways in the saint as a conscious and willing actor, but in just the placement of the body in the shrine complex. Mm-hmm. And for all of those reasons, because I think that's why it's powerful and how it works, it seemed that calling it spirit possession was really misleading. And related to that, spirit possession makes it sound like it's not a religious practice. It's like wacky, out of controlness, and it's associated with women and, you know, I found that really the more that I was at his sanctuary, the more I saw clearly pausery is like a learned behavior. It is a spiritual practice in that way. It's a discipline. It's certainly a form of asceticism. It certainly gives people who practice it the same kind of sort of, I guess you could say, a cultural capital as people who practice various forms of asceticism in the various sort of Sufi and Hindu traditions. All of that I saw clearly, you know, making primarily the women who practiced it sort of feel powerful and actually become powerful in their community. Sort of what they're doing is so physically demanding and so frightening that, you know, to come through that, it makes them and people who know them sort of take notice. And I also thought that whole aspect of the power of the practice was lost in calling it spirit possession, which just sounds like you've got some problems, you know?
Right. So could you
exorcist because you've got problems.
Right. So could you distinguish between the open and hidden presence that you talk about?
That's language that comes from the folks at Hussein Tekeri. So open or hidden presence. So they'll categorize, this was another aspect to sort of why I thought talking about spirit possession, talking about Hazri as spirit possession was really misleading. Open and hidden presence. So the baseline state of a person who has Hazri is that they have Hazri, and they categorize it in sort of two ways, open and hidden, as you say, so that if it's hidden, it means that, you know, you could be at home for many years and not really understand what was wrong. You have recurring physical problems. You feel anxious, all of these things. When you come to Hussein Tekeri, and you begin to sort of exhibit sort of this violent behavior that might get labeled spirit possession, that's what practitioners will call open Hazri. And so it's not like spirit possession in that way, really, either, where I think in English, anyway, spirit possession, it means sort of the crazy behavior of, you know, like the movie The Exorcist or something. The really what in the language of Hazri would be only the open part. But because people who practice open Hazri conceptualize what Hazri is as something that encompasses both sort of the quote unquote crazy violent behavior and just being at home, not feeling well, that seemed to be a category that didn't fit at all with sort of the notion of spirit possession. And that was another reason that it seemed like an inappropriate label to put on the practice, because it isn't just the violent behavior at the shrine. It's also the state of feeling unwell elsewhere.
Yeah. And so in addition to this ritual, I don't know if we can call it a ritual, but
I think I call it a practice.
Okay, so in addition to this practice, another one of the important things that takes place at the shrine that you discuss is this particular type of incense, although as you explain, it's much more than incense. So could you say something about this as well?
I can. The other major practice, healing practice at Hussein Tekeri, Hazri is the, open Hazri is the major healing practice, and it's often something that's brought on by the inhalation of this particular kind of incense that's burned at Hussein Tekeri and is strongly associated with Muslim saint shrine culture throughout the subcontinent. At a certain point late in my research, I did sort of a formal survey of people's sort of understandings of what this kind of incense was and, you know, why it's effective for healing and what sort of places it's associated with. And, well, maybe before I talk about the results of that survey, I should just say very briefly how it's dispensed at Hussein Tekeri. It's really simple and straightforward. The shrine attendants, and this is, the shrine attendants go into the shrines. They stand before the objects that are associated with the various martyrs of Karbala, which come more or less straight out of, sort of Shia practice in South Asia. They light the incense. It sends off huge clouds of smoke right away. They recite some passages from the Quran over it. They pray for the soul of the martyr. And then they take that incense and they walk out of the shrine and they walk through two parallel lines of pilgrims. So the pilgrims sort of are facing one another and there's this path that's created by their bodies. And the shrine attendant just walks between the two lines of pilgrims with this container holding, you know, the lip on with the billowing smoke, and everybody inhales the smoke, is enveloped in the smoke. I'm fairly certain I'm going to die of lung cancer at a very young age. I've been much of this stuff after learning, you know, it's terrible to say. A lot of smoke is what I'm saying. It's not like a little incense stick. It's like clouds of this white fragrant smoke. So it's a really sensual experience. And it's usually that's the substance that often brings on the open hosity in people. So the question then I addressed in countless conversations and then kind of codified far later in my research in sort of this survey that I did was, well, why is the smoke effective? Why does it cause hosity? Why is it powerful? And this gets back to a point I made earlier about one of the reasons that I think these rituals at Muslim saint shrines are so effective and therapeutic is they're incredibly open-ended. Because what I found in this survey is almost anything that I put out there is a possible reason that the smoke would be therapeutic. Some people thought was the case. So is it powerful because it's, you know, is it powerful because it's white? Is it powerful because it's hot? Is it powerful because it's cooling? Is it powerful because the saints are present in it? Is it powerful because jinn are present in it? Is it powerful because it's perfectly pure? Is it powerful because it's white like milk? Is it powerful? I could go on for, you know, how does it make you feel? Does it make you feel heavy or light? Does it make you feel angry or happy? You know, talking about it in terms of body, in terms of emotion, in terms of its physicality, in terms of who or what might be in it. All of the above is sort of what the survey sort of produced as the answer as far as how pilgrims perceive the efficacy of the smoke. And interesting, there wasn't a strong correlation between how people perceived the efficacy of the smoke and what their ethnic or religious background was.
And so now there isn't the idea that, or is there, that there's some type of like narcotic effect going on?
Yeah, you know, I did a little research on this after the fact, and so far as I can tell, no. And in fact, what this is frankincense in English. This kind of incense, and I did find some scientific literature that I'm in no position to evaluate that says that it's actually been demonstrated that frankincense is good for different kinds of arthritis and rheumatism, so it actually has a therapeutic effect. So. On that level, I think that there's a potentially a physical, I don't know what you want to call it, quantifiable effect that the smoke has. But in terms of it being a narcotic or something that makes you high, speaking from my own experience anyway, I can say that's not the case. It just sort of is, you know, makes your throat hurt. That's about it. Yeah. And also, because there's a pretty widely held belief that you can perform hazari for someone else, or you can perform all these healing rituals on behalf of a family member who refuses to come or can't come, you definitely can't attribute the therapeutic effect of the smoke or even the hazari to factors that are exclusively physical or related to the body of the practitioner. There's a social function there, regardless of what the hazari or the smoke of Loban is doing to the practitioner.
So if we could change gears a little bit and get back to one of the things that we're discussing earlier, which is how you had special access to women, and you devote a chapter of the book to discussing women's narratives.
Yeah.
Could you say something briefly about maybe one of those narratives or one of these anecdotes that stands out in your mind that tells us about the types of themes you're discussing in the monograph?
Yes. I'll talk a little bit about a woman in that chapter, what I call Priya, which is not her real name, because she's a really good example of she's representative of sort of things that I observed in non-Muslim pilgrims more generally, particularly women. Also, she's a really interesting person and a lovely person to talk about. So over the years that she went to Hussein Tekedi, for problems that she never, in the book anyway, she never fully understands, but, clearly involved magic, clearly involved, therefore, an inability to be at home and problems with her family, sort of fighting with her family. A lot of detail there, that I can't get into right now. Through her years of going to Hussein Tekedi, she begins to adopt, forms of dress and ritual practice that are explicitly and unambiguously Islamic. So she starts covering her hair, which is the practice that you see in Hindu populations as well. But the style of doing it that she adopts is explicitly Muslim.
Right.
She experiments with wearing a burqa and starts wearing one regularly. She learns to pray namaz, you know, doing the Arabic phonetically. She observes the big fast of the Islamic tradition, right? She's sort of doing all this. She starts, over a course of a number of years, she learns all this from various Muslim mentors at Hussein Taqiri. But all of this that she finds therapeutic for different reasons that she sort of talks about. But if asked explicitly, oh, well, does this mean that you've become a Muslim, she would say, well, no, I mean, of course not, right? And that sort of raises this question of, well, what, you know, in a South Asian context, if you can speak that generally, in an Indian context, I don't know, what makes a person Muslim or Hindu or not? It's obviously really complicated if you have somebody who from the outside is dressing and beginning to eat. She changed her dietary habits, pray in a way that's recognizably Islamic, but is still, you know, asserting a Hindu identity. Sort of, what does that mean? Why is that? What does that mean?
Right. Yeah. It just adds to this multi-layered, I think, complicated way of assessing the different aspects of human identity and religious identity in the South Asian context. And so this relates to something else I wanted to ask you, so you mentioned about how Hindus and other religious groups in India, besides quote unquote Muslims, are happy to visit the shrine. There's no kind of doctrinal problem. But you mentioned that Muslims are less likely to visit Hindu temples, for example. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I guess the first thing I should say is that I think it is true that they are less likely to, but it doesn't mean that they don't. There's been some writing on some sites, particularly in South India, where that, you know, you have sort of patronage of goddess shrines by people who would identify as Muslim if you asked them. So that it's not that it doesn't happen, but right. I do think, I guess I'm hesitating because this wasn't something that I gave a lot of ethnographic attention to at the time, sort of sense of talking about the reasons for that. But I think it's fair to say in a general way that, as Muslims in India particularly have become more conscious of their identity as Muslim, and as sort of communal violence marks people as Muslim or Hindu in a way that's a little bit more centered and concrete than maybe it was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that comes in the Muslim community, I think generally, again, speaking very generally in India, kind of a looking outward to the global Muslim community for sort of camaraderie and identity, because there's such, you know, everybody knows this communalist rhetoric in India that it's not hard to feel alienated if you're identified as a Muslim in some ways, if you pay attention at all. So that has the effect of looking outward, and then various sort of 20th century reformist currents in the Muslim world, a lot of which, as we know, is response to sort of colonial presence around the world, sort of this hardening of Islam in a particular direction, informs the way that Muslims think about themselves in India. And part of the consequence of that is it sort of makes them less inclined to go to a place that is Hindu and religious. That was a very anxious and long answer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think what you say about contextualizing that it's not just some kind of doctrinal issue, but it has to do with
minority
conceptions and colonialism. And it's much more complicated than just this is forbidden or something like that. So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, that's not where it's primarily coming from.
Yeah. So sort of wrapping things up, Your book is obviously geared towards academics on one level. Is there another audience that you're interested in appealing to, or maybe another way of asking that? Do you feel like the research you did for your book opens up conversations that you can have with friends and family about these sort of broader issues that you look at?
I wrote the book in a way that was, I hoped, extremely accessible.
Yeah, and I think it was, by the way.
Thank you. I wanted to... I think there's an anxiety that I share in some ways by sort of academics or academic writing is sort of if it's accessible, does that mean it's good or it's serious? So sort of I wrestled with that anxiety in writing this, but I just, you know, I thought in the end, you know, ultimately a book is a creative, it's the product of a creative process, and it's probably just better to embrace that and write something that seems really accessible and beautiful that you think reflects the reality of the people and the place, rather than, you know, the alternative, which would be to shy away from anything that feels literary. And, you know, because you want to seem serious and, right. And you know, I don't know. I don't want to say accurate, but it was obviously, I didn't make anything up in this book, but I wrote it in a way that was, I thought, like, I don't even know if literary is the right word. I just wanted people to read it and feel like they were there and relate to the people that I talk about in detail as people and characters, the way you, just all of that. So I certainly wrote it hoping that more than, it would be read by more than just sort of my colleagues and friends in the academy. I certainly wrote it in a way that I you know, having said that, I mean, who in this country reads anymore, certainly, like much less reads something that, you know, is put up by a university press. So I guess, I had hoped that it would have, you know, if you picked it up and didn't know anything about South Asia, that you would enjoy it and learn a lot about sort of the way Islam and actually also Hinduism actually are practiced. So I think if you were not an academic and you happened to find a copy of my book, you could open it and read it and enjoy it and learn a lot. I don't know how much that's happening. I think more realistically and hopefully, I have a lot of colleagues and friends who have taught this book in undergraduate classroom settings, sort of a wide range of institutions, and have had really positive experiences. And I've had the chance to visit some of those colleagues and talk to their students after they read the book. And it's just been so, you know, heartening. To sort of listen to the questions that students have and to sort of talk to them about Muslim saint shrines. And then I guess I can also add sort of in my own teaching, I'm a professor at Baruch College. It's part of the City University of New York. One of the sound bites about the institution is it's the most diverse undergraduate institution in the country. Of course it is. It's New York City, right? And that means that I get just about, you know, it means the first day of class, I can't pronounce anyone's name except the South Asians, right? So it's great. You know, when I teach this in the context of my Islam class, I get students with a wide range of ethnic backgrounds who are all kind of identifying as Muslim. Most of them are first generation Americans. And the, you know, being introduced to this kind of, it's just very gratifying, the conversations that this has sparked in my very, very diverse Baruch classrooms as well. You know, South Asian students saying, yes, 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 this is how it is, or really, this is how it is. Or students who have a Muslim background but aren't South Asian saying, really? Or saying, oh, yes, yes, it's very similar to something. And just all of these conversations that it sparked. And then obviously for the non-Muslim and non-South Asian students, just the seeing how very different practice is from what they might think Hinduism is from reading, you know, a popularly recognized Hindu text like the Bhagavad Gita, for example.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's so important that, you know, young students are exposed to how complicated religion is, and that, you know, if, you know, as the example that you gave, you know, someone can fast and cover their head and learn Arabic, but does that make them Muslim? Well, I don't know. It depends who you ask. Right. So,
It depends who you ask.
I think the examples you give and the way you talk about it really complicates that question and raises just the kinds of questions I think that undergraduates could really benefit from. So I'm glad to hear that you've had a positive experience with that in the classroom.
Yeah.
And so we've taken up a bit of your time now, and thank you again so much for joining us today. If we could conclude by asking, what are you working on next? Is it departing from this research or complementing it? What are your future publication plans?
I guess it's both departing and complementing what I've done so far. The I guess there are two primary projects at this point. The first is what I hope will ultimately be a book-length book-length study of discourses and practices of magic in South Asian communities, urban South Asian communities. But because obviously a lot of stuff that I didn't really use explicitly in this first book is sort of stuff about how Muslims and non-Muslims think about magic, and what it is in a South Asian cultural context. Mm-hmm. But the new piece actually come out of all the conversations I've had over the years with my students of South Asian origin at Baruch, where inevitably when I teach this material, after class, they come up to me and I get all manner of reaction, everything from, I'm very sorry that you're teaching this because you make us look like superstitious to the non-South Asians, to, actually, I'm very, very afraid that someone's done magic on me and I don't know who to talk to about it. So there's a real, I guess this first project will be an ethnographic study that is partially based in urban North India and sort of communities there, but is also based in sort of the South Asian diaspora, both Hindu and Muslim, in New York City, particularly, I think, sort of the younger people, I guess you could say, sort of looking at how they think about their identity as Hindu or Muslim in sort of the diaspora context, but through the lens of sort of losing this discourse of magic, I think ultimately, which is so central in some ways to how people think about and talk about their religious identity in India, certainly in the context of healing or dealing with problems in one's life. It can't be taken for granted or used as a discourse in the same way in the South Asian diaspora, at least not that I've seen so far. And so I think that this project will be about tracing the consequences of that loss, both in terms of how people cope with these serious problems, and how they think about their Hinduism or their Islam in the absence of this central South Asian discourse when you're talking about South Asia in the geographical context of South Asia. So that's one. And I guess in some ways that grows out of what I've done so far. And then the other is an ethnography of the rise of the cult of the god of misfortune in Hinduism, who used to be understandably a god you would avoid because misfortune, right? Someone you'd only pay attention to and, patronize a particular caste community in North India that was associated with him if you were having serious problems. Otherwise, you would, just steer clear. But the rise of the cult of the god of misfortune in northern urban Indian settings, particularly Delhi, where I've done most of my research so far, is staggering. One is staggering in the sense that you see these Shani shrines everywhere now, and he's become incredibly popular. And so I've done, going on about a year now total of ethnographic research in a couple of different communities, sort of around this question of why is Shani so popular now? Nobody really wanted anything to do with him 20 or so years ago. And I guess in some ways that grew out of this project because often people with a Hindu background who go to a Muslim saint shrine have at a certain point done various things to try to determine whether their problems are the result of something that Shani is doing. And so in the course of researching this first book, I actually heard quite a bit about Shani and became interested in him through that contact.
Great. Thank you so much for telling us about your future plans. And once again, thank you for joining us during the interview to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me again.
That was my conversation with Carla Bellamy, professor of sociology and anthropology at Baruch College, about her wonderful book, The Powerful Ephemeral, Everyday Healing in an Ambiguously Islamic Place, published by University of California Press, 2011. Thanks for listening.